It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin communities are banding together after powerful storms ripped through the state last Thursday, leading to significant damage in some western and east central counties.
The National Weather Service reports 7 tornadoes touched down and produced winds of more than 100 miles per hour, along with baseball-sized hail.
No major injuries were reported, but some families in the cities of Mayville and Juneau in Dodge County are without homes. 3 EF2-rated tornadoes moved through the region, leading to missing roofs, trees falling on homes, and damage to businesses.
We're checking in on the community's recovery efforts.
Mark Thomas is regional executive and CEO of the American Red Cross of Wisconsin. Mark, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rob. Thank you for having me on.
And Dave Beal is police chief and director of emergency government for the city of Juneau. Chief Beal, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome, Rob, and good morning.
Good morning. Well, Chief Beal, walk us through last week's round of tornadoes. What did you see in terms of storm damage in your community?
When the storm, well, first, the tornado warning was issued about 5:30 p.m., and probably about 20 minutes later, the storm struck, and we experienced at first heavy winds and a torrential downpour of rain. And at that time, we started getting calls that roofs were being torn off houses. And there was actually a fire call that prompted our first response of the fire department to respond to a residence outside of town. And we found that the house was, in fact, not on fire, but it just received some storm damage. When we returned, this was on the west side of town, and when we returned from this call and was headed back in the city, it was at that point that I was looking out the front window of the fire truck and could see trees that had the tops of them torn off. And about the same time, we got reports then that there was a roof tore off a nursing home building up at Clearview with people in it. So that was the first indicator at that point that we had been struck by this storm. Once I got up on North Main Street, up by Clearview, I could see the destruction that had occurred. We had power lines down. The tops of the power poles were snapped off. We had live power lines laying in the roadway, trees all over the place, other debris. And when I looked further up the street, I saw a house with its roof completely tore off it. And that later was the house that had a person trapped in it that was rescued by firefighters and sheriff's personnel.
And Chief Beal, amazing to me, no major injuries reported, happily no fatalities. Was this a case where the system worked? Those warnings got in place and people took them seriously?
I believe so. And in speaking with the director of Clearview, which is a county-owned nursing home that has several hundred residents in it, one of their staff members heard the pre-warnings and started to move the residents out of their rooms into the hallway, shutting doors. They had significant damage. They had windows blown out of the building, which if residents would have been in their room would have been affected by this. Yes, the system worked. It worked well. In the storm damage, it was later seen the north side siren, warning siren, outside warning siren, that actually got struck and got pulled out of the ground and smashed. But previous to that, it sounded, and I can't say enough. The system worked. People heeded the warnings, and I think that definitely played into the fact that we did not have any serious injuries and or fatalities.
Mark, let's bring you into the conversation. When you see damage like this in a Wisconsin community, how does the Red Cross start to offer support?
Thank you. First, let me just say that our heart at the Red Cross, our hearts go out with all to all of those that were affected by the tornado that hit Mayville and other areas last Thursday. And special shout out to Chief Beal and all the first responders. As he mentioned, moving quickly and taking heed and taking the right action when the warning signs came. Surely, I'm sure, save lives and save even additional damage. In the immediate aftermath of the storm, the American Red Cross, we coordinated with many local emergency management folks in that area. And so we wanted to get on the ground as quickly as possible to see how we could help. The way we did that in this community in Mayville was we opened up a shelter later that evening at the local junior and high school over on Clark Street. In the case that if people were displaced and they needed a safe place to stay and a meal, we would act as a hub for that area. Anyone who had been affected was welcome to stop by and get information. As I said, a hot meal, charge their phone, or other essential report. We weren't there to ask for any identification. That people didn't have to stay overnight if they didn't want to. And while no individual stayed overnight at the shelter, the shelter did remain open for 2 days as we were offering food, water, emotional support, and again, a place to just congregate, chat, and maybe charge their cell phone. So we took immediate action to be present within the community for those that were affected.
And Chief Beal, we're a week out now from the event. What does cleanup and recovery look like in your community now?
We were extremely blessed with our locally owned electric utility. That very night, we had our electric utility, along with probably eight other municipally owned utility companies, roll into our community to restore power. They were resetting poles at night, stringing new electric lines, and by about 10:30 at night, we had half the city back on power. And at 2:30 in the morning, about the time I went home, the north side of town was restored. The only residences that weren't restored were the ones that were directly impacted by the storm. So we had a great effort by our electric utility. They were able to work hard and fast and get power restored. The next morning, our DPW called in assistance from other communities and started getting the trees and other debris cleared from the roadway. And as of yesterday, we've had probably the majority of the brush picked up from people's yards, you know, when they dragged it out to the curb. And we'll continue those efforts along with working on our electric. We had a substation that was hit during the storm, and that still is offline, and they're working to get that back online. Fortunately, we are fed by different feeds to the city, and we have a substation on the south end of town that's basically powering the city at this time.
Mark, for people who were more directly affected, who maybe lost their home, can't move back in, what kind of help is available? What kind of services can someone like the Red Cross maybe connect them with to figure out what comes next?
Yeah, so what we did on Friday and Saturday was we were out in the community on Friday distributing cleanup kits, as the chief mentioned. So we were providing folks who could maintain their home with bags, gloves, rakes, tarps. And those folks that were more affected, we opened up cases for them. So they're working with a Red Cross caseworker. So far, we've opened up 10 cases and willing to open up more if need be. And that will connect them with health and mental health services, financial assistance, and other needs that they may have. People that are affected by disasters and storms like this can connect with us at the Red Cross disaster relief area by going to redcross.org. or giving us a call at 1-800-RED-CROSS, and we can work with them to open up a case. It depends on each situation is dealt with individually, and so we will connect people with resources that they need to develop a pathway for moving forward.
Briefly, I want to look to the future. Mark, if people are thinking, hey, a tornado could hit any place in Wisconsin, I want to help if God forbid that happens. How can people get involved as volunteers for when that emergency strikes?
Yeah, so I'll talk about the volunteers in a second, but I would say to anyone listening, and I think the folks at Clearview did a great job, make sure that you understand what it means to have a warning versus a watch. A watch means be prepared. A warning means take action immediately. And if you hear the siren or if you see thunder and it's rolling towards you, get to a safe place indoors. If you're in a car, pull off to the side of the road so that you don't get hit by, falling trees or power lines. And so we want people to take those warnings very seriously. And again, it sounds like the folks at Clearview did. If you'd like to become a Red Cross volunteer to be potentially trained in things like CPR or disaster relief, again, 1-800-RED-CROSS is a number that you can call. Go to our website, redcross.org, or text the word Red Cross to 90999, and you'll be connected with us. We are always looking for volunteers, people that are willing to help within their own communities.
Chief Beal, just 30 seconds left. If you had one lesson for your fellow first responders around the state to prepare, what would you tell them?
Be prepared, train, and develop those partnerships early on. I have a great relationship with the Sheriff's Department and other police departments throughout the county, and also with Red Cross and Dodge County Public Health. They all played a huge part in our response efforts, and things went very smoothly in the city of Juneau.
Chief Beal, thanks for joining us today, and best of luck to your community.
Thank you.
And Mark, thanks for being with us.
Appreciate it. Have a great day.
Been talking to Mark Thomas, Regional Executive, CEO of the American Red Cross of Wisconsin, and Dave Beal, Police Chief, Director of Emergency Government with the City of Juneau, looking at the aftermath of the tornadoes that struck Dodge County last week.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a bill circulating in the state legislature would allow communities to open cigar lounges. Hear from a lawmaker in the Fox Valley who is behind this proposal.
There's this really, really cool bonding experience within cigar lounges, and I hope to give more people across the state that access.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's 2010 indoor smoking ban left exemptions for existing cigar bars to continue allowing the smoking of cigars and pipes, but no new establishments could open.
Now a proposal in the state legislature would change the law to allow more cigar bars to open and leave it up to local governments to decide whether they want to issue new tobacco bar licenses in their communities.
Republican State Representative Nate Gustafson introduced similar legislation in the last session, and it didn't make it to a vote, but this version of the bill has more bipartisan support than the previous attempt. He represents a district that covers much of the Winnebago County area surrounding Oshkosh, Neenah, and Menasha. Representative Gustafson, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
So why introduce a bill to allow for more cigar bars? What is the thinking behind this?
Absolutely. And, a lot of times as a representative, people think that we go down to Madison and we just kind of come up with ideas that we think are good. But actually, most of our ideas come from our constituents. And that's exactly where this bill came from. Actually having a conversation at a cigar lounge with a constituent who said, it'd be awesome if I'd be able to actually have the opportunity to open up a cigar lounge of my own. And I, simply asked, why can't you? And we found out, obviously, within state statute, going all the way back to the smoking ban, actually, there had been a grandfather clause in there that prevented any new tobacco bar licenses, which tobacco bar is the legal definition of a cigar lounge, could be issued after June 3rd, 2009. So this bill originated last session, actually, as when I was in my freshman term, that I actually tried to strike the June 3rd date. That was my simple fix, I thought, but nothing is simple down in Madison when it comes to legislation. So we kind of got the wheels turning, at least on the first session with that one. And then we had some stakeholders come to us and ask for some changes. And so we were obliged to take those for the fact that I believe that it made it a better bill. And so this session, AB 211, has actually added another stipulation if you're going to open up a new cigar lounge. So starting June 4th, 2009, and going forward, you can only maintain a tobacco bar license or a retail food establishment license. So a restaurant today could not go and become a cigar lounge tomorrow if this bill was to pass. And that was, obviously, we had a lot of restaurants that had come to us and said, you know, we don't want people thinking our industry is just going to become a bunch of smoking lounges, or even worse, revert back to the pre-smoking ban days. And so we agreed that was not our intent of the legislation. And so we were able to change that language within the bill to make sure that we captured our actual intent and get more stakeholders on board with this bill and feel that, you know, this is something that not only one area of the state might benefit from, but every spot of the state. And so that's what we've really been seeing is the coalition building this session on this bill alone has been tremendous and a lot more expansive than I could have ever imagined. And because of that, too, we've seen additional Democrats come along board on this bill as well, as they also appreciate the feedback and the change that was made.
What do you tell communities, though, who don't want these lounges in their jurisdiction? Does this bill eliminate local control for communities?
That's a fantastic point. So with this bill, essentially, I've been telling a lot of my colleagues, this is actually a true local control bill. So again, if today this bill was to be signed by the governor, the local municipality ultimately still gets the authority if they want to issue a tobacco bar license. So a good example, and I've had conversations, I don't want to call out too many people, but I've had some conversations, especially in the Madison area, with some of the cigar lounge owners there, and they were a little uneasy if this bill was to pass, what that meant for their business. And I was able to kind of walk them through the process that, you know, I don't particular see maybe the city of Madison wanting to issue a new tobacco bar license just because this bill passed. And because of that, we've seen some more support from especially those in the industry getting on board, and some of them may be coming to testify actually when this bill comes up for a hearing. So again, it's really about local control. It's not about the state coming in and dictating. It's about the local municipalities, and if they are comfortable with it and their constituents want it, they should have that ability to do so.
We're talking with Republican State Representative Nate Gustafson about his bill that would allow for more cigar bars to open in Wisconsin. What kind of enforcement mechanisms or guardrails would be in place or are currently in place to make sure cigar bars follow the rules of their tobacco bar license?
Yeah, under current statute, the tobacco bar actually has a couple criteria it must meet to qualify as a tobacco bar. And the main one is that 15% of their gross income must come from cigars or pipe tobacco. So that means no matter whatever else they might be selling, typically it's not food. Typically it's going to be on the side of alcohol that they serve alongside the tobacco products that they're allowed to sell. There has to be at least 15% of their sales. Now, the other criteria is I mentioned cigars and tobacco, and that sounds kind of almost pointed why those two are called out. Well, to be considered a pipe tobacco or a tobacco bar, you're only actually allowed to smoke cigars or pipe tobacco within these lounges. So if you were to enter one of these facilities and or businesses and let's say light up a cigarette, that's a big no-no. Usually I've seen it with my own eyes. You're almost ran out. You'll be given a very stern warning if you attempt to do it. And that's kind of the culture of the cigar lounges. It's not just this free-for-all smoking venue. It's a lot typically on the premium end of the tobacco products where individuals can come, have conversation, bridge the gap between communities, and have a good time without having to worry about the direct impact of, let's say, some of the health issues that could come with some of the inhaling that's done with certain tobacco products versus pipe tobacco or cigars.
But still, the American Lung Association and UW Health have come out in opposition and have concerns here. What do you say to people who might be concerned about the negative health impacts of more indoor smoking opportunities?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, individuals are going to have to make their own choices. And I don't think it's the government's role to come in and ultimately stop someone from pursuing this business opportunity, as well as some of the health aspects that are associated with these cigar lounges. Typically, there's plenty of studies out there that show that when you're smoking a cigar or pipe tobacco, because of the fact that you aren't inhaling, there is definitely a reduced risk. Now, also with these new lounges, you see these filtration systems that are on the ceiling that ensure that you're having a good air quality experience while you're still smoking these tobacco products. And so I'll give a shout out for one of the newer lounges that I know of in Monona, the Tasting Room. Jason has done a wonderful job creating this new lounge that has excellent air filtration, and it really makes it a welcoming atmosphere for even those who might be a little, adherent to maybe wanting to stick to some public health standards. But I think at the end of the day, it's really someone's choice. And I think we should make sure that maybe down the road, we can have some conversations about making sure it's a little bit more clear about some of the adherent risk maybe that someone may face if they enter a cigar lounge, whether that's signage on a door or maybe for the employee's safety, giving them notice about some of the secondhand smoke risk before they maybe take or accept a job at one of these establishments.
You, it sounds, have personal experiences at cigar lounges, and you talked about having a social connection. I'm wondering, do you find it for you personally more of like a third space?
I absolutely. And I think one of the coolest things about our cigar lounge culture, not only in our state, but across the U.S., is when you walk in, you might come in thinking you're going to be labeled one way or another, but a lot of times you come in and it feels like family. Almost every single lounge you go into, and you have conversations that maybe people won't want to have out in public, or maybe sometimes those conversations are the ones that we see getting heated on social media. But at the end of the day, we walk away with a greater respect for each other. And I think that's what our society needs right now, is a space where we can have open dialogue and debate the ideas and issues of the day, but know that we're both humans, we're both neighbors, and we must respect, you know, obviously within our own boundaries that we live by each other. And so we all, I think, ultimately want the goal of having our best communities that we possibly can live in. And so that's where there's this really, really cool bonding experience within cigar lounges. And I hope to give more people across the state that access.
Before we go, what kind of timeline are you looking for getting to the floor for a vote and potentially to the governor's desk?
Yeah, I mean, I would like... obviously, we have to get through the committee process on both sides, the Senate and the Assembly. I'd like to see probably a hearing pretty soon here. I know I'm in some conversations with the chair of the State Affairs Committee, Representative Swearingen, who has been very gracious to hear me out on this and seems to be pretty open to having a hearing somewhat soon. Then at that point, I think if we get past those hurdles within that committee, it probably will get to the floor pretty darn quick after that. And then from the other perspective, from the Senate side, I haven't heard a lot of opposition really from that side either. I would say hopefully we can have something done by early fall and get to the governor and have his obviously have his final approval if he agrees with us or not.
Representative Gustafson, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you again for the opportunity.
That is Republican Representative Nate Gustafson of Fox Crossing. He was with us to share the details of his proposed bill to allow for more cigar bar licenses in Wisconsin.
Now we're focusing on the existing cigar bar industry here in the state. Currently, Wisconsin has fewer than two dozen active tobacco bar licenses. One of those belongs to Maduro Cigar Bar in Madison that's owned by Vanessa Shipley. Vanessa, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Glad to be here.
Now, you're in kind of a unique situation, right, with a cigar, a tobacco bar in Wisconsin. They were sort of grandfathered in when this legislation got passed. Can you talk about what regulation looks like for you now, how people make sure you are, you know, in the various categories to still fit in the bounds of current law?
We have to make sure that no one's smoking cigarettes in the bar and it's just cigars and pipe tobacco only. And for the most part, we really don't have a problem. People that come from other places that aren't familiar maybe with how it goes in Wisconsin, if they light up a cigarette, we're on it right away. Sorry, you can't do that. I know it seems strange maybe, but you can go outside and finish your cigarette outside. When the ban first happened, it was just in Madison, not in the whole of Wisconsin. So we had an experience being closed to smoking, open still as a bar, for about 9 months. And that was a very rough time. So it was great that then an exemption was made for us at that time, which later became a grandfather clause for the rest of the state.
Now, for people who don't smoke cigars or pipes and might not have experienced this, what is the appeal of having a bar where people get together and smoke cigars and pipes?
I would say definitely having a lot of conversations with regulars and other customers over the years. We all can agree on that a cigar bar has a different kind of feel of camaraderie. It's a great way to meet people. You already have one thing in common when you walk through the door is cigars, and it just has, in general, a different vibe. I've gone to a lot of different bars that are not cigar bars, and I will say going to a cigar bar gives you like a step up in meeting people and having conversation.
Now, here's this new legislation. It could open the door to more cigar bars, tobacco bars being opened up. There's still going to be some local government control over how that happens. I could see you reacting in a couple of ways. It could be, yay, great, more peers, welcome to the club. Or it could be, oh, no, more competition for the thing I'm doing. What are you looking at as you see this legislation be reintroduced?
Yeah, my initial reaction is positive. I think that the cigar culture is a wonderful thing, and having more places around the state of Wisconsin would definitely be a good thing and encourage more people to maybe develop, you know, a new hobby. My only concern was, obviously, I don't want one across the square from my bar in direct competition. But it was my understanding that this is for the whole state, not necessarily a place, you know, like Madison would have to approve being another cigar bar downtown in order for that to happen. And I'm not really worried about that at the moment. It seems like this is meant for areas outside of Madison or smaller areas.
Yeah, what would you, having had this experience now for a couple decades in the cigar bar business, assuming this passed, what would you want to see for communities or suggest for communities to weigh, hey, do we want a tobacco bar? Do we want it here? Do we want two? Do we want 20? Whatever the case may be.
I think it's a strange thing to me, it seems strange that a community would react in a certain way of wanting one or not wanting one, since it would just be a business that people are welcome to go into or not go into.
Sure.
So I don't know what kind of things a community considers allowing it versus not allowing it. Mm-hmm.
Now, part of the whole deal with indoor smoking bans, first when Madison had one, then we had the state one with this small exemption for tobacco bars, was concern over the health of employees and of customers with that indoor smoke. Is that something, as somebody who's worked now in this environment for a long time, something you worry about or think about for yourself or your staff there?
I don't really. And everyone who works there knows exactly what they're getting into.
Sure.
I mean, I had a bartender that worked for me years ago who, you know, did the Ironman, and he was a gymnastics instructor, big athlete, and even he really liked working in that space.
Now, you talked about feeling like it's a community of people at the cigar bar. Do you feel like with other people operating these kind of businesses around the state, are you in contact with them? Do you work together, trade ideas, or you're kind of all out there on your own?
No, absolutely. We are definitely a community. I know the owners of both the other cigar bars in Madison. We're friends. I frequent their establishments. They frequent mine. It's definitely a cigar community, you know, among the three of us.
And talk about the people. What is the mix of people who people might have a stereotype of the cigar smoker, right, or the pipe smoker? Well, the stereotype was my dad for years.
Yeah.
But what does the reality of your clientele look like?
People ask that question a lot when they come into the bar. They say, oh, you must get a lot of politicians and lawyers and stuff in here. I say, well, we get some, but we get a cross-section. We get some younger people. We get some professionals. We get some nurses. I mean, there's no specific demographic, I would say, but people tend to think that maybe we're just getting guys in suits and that's it, right? Which is not true.
And the old school stereotype, and I don't know if this is still even a stereotype now, is this is guys, right? This is men who are out there smoking cigars.
Yes.
Well, here you are. is that even a stereotype anymore among people who smoke cigars? Or is it? Does it seem like there's more and more women and it's just normal now?
I don't know. Definitely still is a stereotype. And yes, there are some times when I'm bartending and I look around and realize I'm one of the only females in the room. But then there are also some nights when I look around and it's 50-50, you know, men and women. So I'd say it still is, you know, there still are a lot of men and maybe majority men, but it's not a fair stereotype anymore.
Now, getting back to the environment and the place, you know, a lot of people talk about, hey, we don't have places to go and mingle with other people anywhere at home, we're at work. And then if we're at the bar, we're at the bar with the people we came into the bar with.
Yeah.
Do conversations happen, right, from different groups, from random people, maybe just the regulars at your establishment?
A lot, and not even just among regulars. If there's someone that, say, is traveling for a business and they're sitting at the bar by themselves, 80 or 90% of the time, there'll be a regular sitting down the bar who's like, hey, who are you? Why are you here? And they spark up a conversation. I've seen so many friendships happen, phone numbers exchanged. Yeah, all the time. It's one of my favorite things about the bar, actually.
Now, we've got this legislation. It's been advanced before and failed. Are you hopeful that this is going to pass this time and open the door to other communities looking at having their own cigar bars?
I mean, I don't have any skin in the game. I'm not going to open up another bar, but I think it's a positive thing. Absolutely. And, you know, the fact that people might want to do it and cannot do it is negative. Yeah, I think there should be more.
All right. Vanessa, thank you so much for coming up to the studio. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Vanessa Shipley is owner of Maduro Cigar Bar in Madison. She was with us to talk about the cigar bar industry in Wisconsin after state lawmakers proposed a bill to allow for more tobacco bar licenses in the state. Earlier, we heard from Republican State Representative Nate Gustafson about the specifics of the bill and its current status at the Capitol.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, Max Gene Noel was a legendary diver and inventor from Wisconsin, and his memoir tells his story, finally published 65 years after his death.
He was just compelled and drawn to water and continued pushing the limits of exploration, the limits of the human body, the limits of discovery.
That's next from WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about bird watching and friendship.
One day each spring, volunteers around Wisconsin get up at dawn to participate in the annual Midwest Crane Count. It's a long-running citizen science project that helps collect data about sandhill and whooping cranes. As WPR's Rochelle Wilson tells us, it's also a chance for some people to connect with friends.
It's 4 a.m. on a Saturday morning, an hour for early birds. Thousands of volunteers have set their alarms and are heading out to their local wetlands and birding hotspots to look and listen for cranes.
Are you normally up this early?
No.
That's Mark Hendrickson and Mark Hansen, longtime crane count veterans. Hendrickson first volunteered for the count in 1979, just 3 years after the very first sandhill crane count in Columbia County.
When I was heading out in 1979, three cranes got up right next to me from the marshland and did their slow motion flapping of their wings and took off. And I go, wow, I have to do this again.
Eventually, Hansen joined him. You might say these guys are birds of a feather. They often get together to go hiking, hunting, or fishing. They tell me that they don't consider themselves birders, but the crane count is a beloved annual tradition for the Marks. And they've been coming back to the same spot each year, the Goose Lake Wildlife Area near Deerfield.
There are some sites in Wisconsin where you might see lots and lots of cranes. We're not one of them.
Every year, Hansen and Hendrickson hike about 45 minutes to their trusty lookout spot overlooking marshland. I say lookout, but really it's more about listening. One truism of birding is that you often hear a bird before you see it. We get there just before 5:30, when the count officially starts. For the first half hour, we hear all kinds of birds. Geese, cardinals, and a woodcock. But no cranes. Not yet.
They're sleeping late today.
Hendrickson keeps a notebook of their observations that goes back decades. He writes down every time they see or hear cranes. Later in the day, he sends the numbers to the International Crane Foundation.
Yeah, I know. You know, I'm not chronological here. Like in 03, we saw quite a few flying.
Around 6 a.m., we hear them. The first crane calls of the day.
There we are.
Bingo.
Yep, there we are.
One had to wake the rest of them up.
Yeah.
It's not an exact science, but the data provides a helpful snapshot for conservation biologists to understand how many cranes are in Wisconsin and where their breeding grounds are. After hearing that first call, we move deeper into a more wooded area by the marsh's edge. A little while later, a second round of crane calls. Eventually, a third. Our 2 hours are up. We didn't see any cranes, but we heard 8 pairs. Walking back to the car, I ask the Marks what they think about the proposed Sandhill crane hunt in Wisconsin. Hendrickson doesn't hunt. Hansen says he hunts pheasants, but wouldn't hunt cranes.
Cranes are kind of spiritual in a way, I think. You know, they're not meant for eating. They're a symbol of evolution in a way. You know, they're really, really old. They've been around for millions of years.
For Hendrickson and Hansen, the crane count helps them stay connected with each other and to the land.
You get a sense of ownership of the land. I mean, this is state land, this is DNR land, but for these 2 hours on a Saturday morning, it's our land.
It's our land.
That was a deep concept.
WPR's Rochelle Wilson brought us that story on the annual Midwest Crane Count. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Wisconsin is hundreds of miles from any sea or ocean, but a pioneer in the field of deep sea diving was born and raised and even worked here in Wisconsin.
Milwaukee's Max Gene Knoll revolutionized diving techniques and technology and dove extensively in the Great Lakes and around the world. And he was a world record holder.
In December 1937, Knoll dove 420 feet to the bottom of Lake Michigan, shattering the world record for the deepest dive. Here's a clip from a radio broadcast from the boat.
Max Knoll invented this diving suit and went to a record depth to speak on the radio.
You're on the bottom? Well, wait a minute, we'll find the depth. What's the depth there?
420 feet.
420 feet, that's a record, Max.
He said he could have gone to 500 and the ocean bed got in the way.
Knoll wrote a memoir recounting his escapades in diving, but it went unpublished. He died in a car crash in 1960.
For more than 60 years, the document sat in the Milwaukee Public Library archives until now. It's called I Live Underwater, The Thrilling Adventures of a Record-Breaking Diver, Treasure Hunter, and Deep Sea Explorer.
Tamara Thompson is a maritime archaeologist at the Wisconsin Historical Society and a diver herself. She wrote the foreword to the book. Tamara, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I got to admit, I didn't know about the story of Max Knoll. Amazing story. As a diver yourself, when did you first start learning about Max Knoll?
Oh, it wasn't early. I kind of thought that Cousteau was, you know, the father of scuba diving and nothing happened before. You know, he came into making movies and television shows and that. And then all of a sudden, one of my friends encountered one of the chapters that Max Gene Knoll had written at Milwaukee Public Library. And he passed it on to me. And I just kind of, I leapt into his shoes thinking that, you know, I'm a diver here in Wisconsin. What do I have to contribute? I'm not on one of the coasts. I, you know, won't make important discoveries. And here this person was living about 50 years before me and making all of these important contributions to the sport.
Right. He goes to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, mm-hmm. MIT, to learn the engineering he needs to make better equipment. Can you talk about the kind of diving he was doing with, at that point, yeah. almost 100-year-old principles and a hose attached to everything?
Yeah, he got a hold of a used hard hat diving helmet, so it's called standard dress, and he learned to use that from a fellow student. And they took it in Walden's Pond and went to the bottom on an icy icy afternoon, and that's really what hooked him into this. And he did everything he could to acquire a suit and gear for himself. Now, when he left MIT, his thesis was actually on diving, and he built himself a bathysphere. So it's like a pressurized sphere. He took some time off and he went on a very important expedition called the Seth Parker Expedition into the Caribbean. So he's hired on with the, you know, this kind of adventurous that have a radio program that they broadcast weekly and talk about all of the discoveries they make. And the one thing that they wanted was Max Jean Knoll to come there and to bring this bathysphere.
I hope that diving has changed such that people aren't trying to, your crewmates aren't trying to stab you or one another. This was a thing that happened multiple times, the expeditions that Max goes on.
Yeah, it's not so ruthless today.
Good.
I'm more selective of my buddies, I guess. So there's a wider pool also of divers to select from, but it's not so, you know, macho as it was back in the day.
Now, I mentioned the early diving he's doing is with the hose attached.
Yeah.
And SCUBA, the acronym I know starts with self-contained.
Right.
And a lot of the work that Max and the people he's working with are doing is, hey, how can we dive deep without a hose attached? Can you talk about the sort of experiments they were doing, the sort
sure.
of innovations they were coming
yeah,
up with?
Yeah, so again, he's surrounding himself with these interesting characters. One guy is John Craig. So John Craig was Danger Is My Business was his book. They went on, again, an expedition in the Caribbean, and they invented for that the self-swimming aqualung. So very similar to what Cousteau came out with 5 years later. But they were using it to shoot photograph fish down in the Caribbean. So that's kind of one of those innovations. The other thing that he did to go deeper was he built a rebreather diving suit. So a rebreather is, we still use them today. In fact, I was using them yesterday when I was in the field. But they are a recirculating device. So as you exhale, it goes through a scrubber material, which takes out the carbon dioxide, and then another mixture of gases, oxygen and other bulking gas comes in, and it allows you to breathe. So they built this suit, this innovative suit, and then they were testing that. And in the testing of it, they discovered they needed to go deeper. And the Navy in 1924 had stopped doing testing on helium as a deep diving gas. Knoll and a physiologist out of Marquette University had been working with, they'd been working with caisson workers. These are people that were working in the tunnels in Milwaukee. And so they had developed the bends, decompression sickness, the same thing that's happened with divers. And they were working on how to treat them. And in doing so, they had access to this chamber at the Milwaukee General Hospital. And so they began testing deep diving mixtures to be able to push the limits of diving. So a helium-oxygen combination. They figured out the tables, the timetables, the steps it takes you to come up to the surface. And to test that, they did a few workup dives, but then they got on a Coast Guard cutter. They went out to what they thought was going to be the deep diving limit, 360 feet of water. It turned out the charts were wrong, and they were actually in 420 feet. And Max went down to the bottom. He'd got below 360 and decided he was going to go for the bottom because he needed to prove he was that deep. So grabbed hit the bottom at 420, grabbed a handful of dirt, and came up. Meanwhile, Dr. Edgar Ann, the physiologist, is on the boat, you know, with a slide rule, trying to extrapolate out these tables and figure out how to get this guy to the surface alive.
With decompression.
With decompression, yeah. So, and they're having to do the stops. And when he got him up, he had set the world deep diving record. And that stood for several decades.
We're talking to Tamara Thompson, maritime archaeologist at the Wisconsin Historical Society. She wrote the foreword for this new memoir of the late Max Jean Knoll, a pioneer in the field of deep sea diving. It's called I Live Underwater. One of his projects later, before his life was cut short, was trying to bring up a ship from the bottom of Lake Michigan, the Prince Willem V, sunk in 1954, mm-hmm. I want to say. He didn't complete that. But that ship is in some ways a diving mecca in the United States.
Yeah, it's been on the bottom for a little bit over 50 years. So, it draws divers from all over the country. It always makes the lists of places to dive in the United States, number one wreck dives, that type of thing. And we get people that come from all over. In fact, it's probably the most dived shipwreck in Wisconsin waters. It's really cool. It's this huge Dutch freighter that's laying on its side, stretched out on the bottom. You can reach the wreck at about 35 feet. And the main wreckage is really down about the 55, 60. So it's very accessible for beginning divers. And even if you wanted to go a little deeper, if you go back by the stern, where the name Prince Willem is still printed on the stern in Rotterdam, that takes you to about 80 feet. So it's very attainable for a lot of people. But Max saw that was very, very close to where he was living in Milwaukee. He put in a bid to raise it. On a technicality, the contract was to clear the area over the shipwreck so it wouldn't be a hazard to navigation. And he found that there was just this gangplank that was obstructing the navigation. So he removed the gangplank. And then through a series of lawsuits, because they didn't realize it was going to be so easy, obtained rights to own the ship. And then this whole series of failed attempts happen on how they're going to go about raising it with a series of balloons, with all kinds of pontoons inside. And then, as they were reorganizing and trying to make another attempt on it, Max was killed coming back from a vacation in Mexico.
Now, you're someone who dives for fun and for work as a profession. Same with Max. He was fascinated by the undersea world, but also very, very practically minded, it seemed like. Do you feel a kinship with this guy from half a century ago?
Oh, absolutely. So all of the things that, downturns in his career, I have parallels those two. So this rise and failure, this always constantly seeking adventure, wanting to find where the next cool thing is. I do feel a very close kinship with him.
Reading the work he was doing early on. Now, scuba sounds dangerous enough to me, someone who's never done it, and something you got to be really careful with. Now, he's at some points going with this helmet that his buddy made because he read about how to do it in a magazine. Is it harrowing to you as a diver who knows what the risks are to read about what he was doing?
Yeah, I don't know that I would take the instructions from Popular Mechanics and try to make myself a tin can helmet. But I don't think I'm that adventurous. But there's certainly some, something that makes me want to try it.
Okay. The book, your project to help get this book published is complete. You're holding in front of me the actual finished copy. What do you hope people take away from Max's story?
That good things can happen to divers in Wisconsin. So it doesn't have to be that, I thought when I learned to dive that I would have to constantly go on vacation to be able to get underwater and to seek adventure and to see cool things. There are so many cool things right in our backyard. Just open yourself up to that adventure. And this, being in Wisconsin shouldn't be limiting. So for someone that wants to explore.
Tamara, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Tamara Thompson, maritime archaeologist at the Wisconsin Historical Society. She wrote the foreword for a new posthumously published memoir of Max Gene Knoll, a Wisconsin pioneer in the field of deep sea diving. That newly published book is called I Live Underwater, The Thrilling Adventures of a Record-Breaking Diver, Treasure Hunter, and Deep Sea Explorer. That was a fascinating story about a Wisconsin diver. I had no idea about it going in, and that's always fun here on Wisconsin Today when we learn something about our state that's been under the radar or underwater, I guess.
That's true. And we're wondering, is there a story like that or a person like that in your community, a local legend who you think more people should know about?
Or maybe someone from Wisconsin who's had a huge influence in your profession or your hobby? Tell us about it. Could be fuel for a future conversation. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232.
Music. Wisconsin Today producers include Courtney Everett, Lauren Cox, and Beatrice Lawrence. Our technical directors are Jeff Robbins and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.